Tell me a little bit about the work that you do for Global Fund for Women.
Okay. Well, right now, what we are doing for Global Fund for Women is legislative advocacy for the domestication of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. We're trying to domesticate or get the legislature to incorporate the provisions of the convention into national law. And this is necessary because of our constitutional provision. You know, when you talk about treaties, there are different ways that different countries approach treaty making. If, for instance, a Commonwealth country like Nigeria signs onto a treaty, there are three different steps, three different procedures. One, there's a signature, then there's ratification, and then the third is, by our own constitution, we are required that no treaty, whether it is ratified or not, is applicable in Nigeria unless it has been incorporated, the provisions have been incorporated into our national laws. So that third step is what is creating the problems for us. Nigeria has ratified most of the international human rights treaties, but now the fact is to bring it home by domestication. So what we are trying to do with the CEDAW Convention is to, we have a domestication bill, which is titled the Gender and Equal Opportunities Bill. What this bill is trying to do is to incorporate provisions of CEDAW as well as the provisions of the Protocol to the African Charter on the Rights of Women in Africa. So this is a homegrown treaty in Africa because, of course, you know, some countries are saying you are bringing in CEDAW, which is an European, you know, document to impose on Africans. So now we've been able to get the African Union itself to come up with a homegrown treaty, which is very comprehensive on human rights. Nigeria has signed, Nigeria has ratified, but Nigeria has not domesticated. So what this bill is trying to do is to domesticate these two instruments. So Global Fund has come to the rescue because we have the bill at the national level, which is being funded by, you know, Justice for Peace, which is a DFID project. But we have the bill pending in 23 states. So Global Fund came on board. We applied to say, can you support the project in one of the 23 states. So Global Fund has taken Lagos State, which used to be the federal capital of Nigeria. So the bill is now moving in the legislature, sponsored by the Global Fund for Women.
What are the prospects of the bill getting passed, and what's the time frame?
Well, it is difficult. Legislative advocacy is a very slow process. This bill, to be honest, has been in the legislature from about year 2000. So we've been going back and forth. Recently, the Senate threw out the bill because a few of the members came up with opposition based on culture, said that joint ownership of property between husband and wife is contrary to the Quran, for instance. Some came up with religious reasons. So the bill was stepped down. We are working on it. Advocacy trying to explain that this has nothing to do with culture or with religion. There's nothing wrong with that provision. So this is where we are, and Global Fund is funding the advocacy. In terms of time frame, I cannot tell you that it's going to pass tomorrow or next. What has happened is that because the Senate threw out the bill in April, the other states are now standing by. You see, it has a ripple effect. Now other state legislatures are saying, okay, let us watch the national what the national legislature is going to do. So now we have been assured. The Senate President has assured us that the bill will come back. The bill has actually passed through first reading again before the Senate, and he says he's taking it upon himself to ensure that before they leave, within the next 2-3 years, the law will be passed. And once it is passed at the national level, it has a ripple effect. All the states will follow suit.
Slowly, do you feel support is building?
For the bill? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. You know, one other problem we have in Nigeria is that because of lack of understanding by the women themselves, some people have actually branded me an abortionist, you know, that the CEDAW is about abortion and they don't want to hear about abortion and stuff. But what we're trying to do is to say that this bill is all-encompassing. It is not necessarily an abortion bill. So the point I'm trying to make is that even the women themselves do not understand that this bill, that they need this bill to be able to protect and enforce their rights. Now, opposition is reducing because we are creating awareness. We have published the full text of the bill. We are trying to disseminate it widely so that people will see that this has very progressive provisions that will enable women to protect their rights. So now we are building more support. And what we are trying to do is to involve men. We've been talking to women, but we now know that if the men do not go along, it will be difficult to pass. So we're trying to engage through the religious leaders, through cultural leaders, get them involved and get them to be part of the advocacy so that, you know, this bill will be passed in no time.
Let's get into the specifics of the bill. Does it protect the rights of gay and lesbian communities as well as women's right to property and the right to vote and so forth?
Okay, talking about this bill, I tell you, the rights of LGBTs, you know, in Nigeria is not being discussed because there's already a law that makes it a crime. So anyone that comes out in the open to declare status, it's liable, could be tried and sentenced to jail for 14 years. Within the law as well, if one attends a wedding of a same-sex marriage, that person, by the mere fact that you've attended the wedding, could be prosecuted and put in jail. So the bill does not have any protection on that. The CEDAW Convention does not even have protection on that. So what we are trying to do is to domesticate these treaties. So these treaties, none of the treaties I mentioned the rights of LGBTs. Generally, we talk about the rights of vulnerable persons. And within CEDAW, we consider LGBT groups as vulnerable groups, because they are being killed, murdered, persecuted in different countries. And we're saying, well, they are individuals whose rights need to be protected. So, but in Nigeria, the discussion is not on because it's a crime already. In terms of property, the bill talks about joint ownership of property, the right of women to buy property, own property, manage property by themselves. And this is the crux of the matter. People, some male chauvinists are still saying no, we cannot own properties jointly with women according to their culture, according to their religion. The opposition also came up on the article that talks about widowhood and inheritance. You know, it's a big issue in some parts of Nigeria where women do not inherit. If a woman does not have a male child, inheritance is out of the question. So even if a woman has a male child, she inherits through her male child, not in her capacity as a woman. So these are all issues that are on ground. And the provision of this bill on inheritance says that where somebody is widowed, she has the first choice to take custody of her children. It is only where you can prove that she's not capable that you can talk about having other people having custody. And this was one of the things they opposed to. And we are trying to encourage men to understand that when you are alive and you are opposing this kind of provisions, you have not made proper provisions for your family. When something happens, you'll be surprised at what your own brothers do, because the standard of living you have set for your family, it has to crash. Your brothers, they are your brothers, you've made them next of kin. What happens is they take on your estate and your children don't have access to it, your wife don't have access to it, your family is pushed into poverty. And this is not what any man wants. But you see, when you talk about it, it's like, you know, for them, no, it's not going to happen, but it does happen. So this is the way we are tackling it right now. Make provisions for your family, even if your wife is evil, she is still the most qualified person to take care of your children. So this is what we are preaching. So this is part of the provisions of this bill. CEDAW, the protocol to the African Charter, actually provides for abortion, medical abortion. It gives four different instances where state parties should relax their laws to ensure that women have access to abortion. And one is when a woman has been raped. One is when incest has occurred. The third one is where the life or the health of the woman is in danger. And finally, where the fetus has been confirmed to be severely malformed. You will not encourage a woman to have, you know, this baby that may not survive. So what we are trying to, the protocol, we had it in the Gender and Equal Opportunities Bill, but all religious leaders were against it. Even some women themselves were against it. The bill was thrown out completely because of this provision. So we are advised to take this provision out, have this bill passed, then it could be, you know, a question of amendment to get it in when the communities are ready to discuss this. But there are several rights to equality in employment, talking about remove pay gaps between a man and a woman working. There's a right to health, where government is urged to provide facilities for women, maternity facilities, and when you do this, it's not considered discrimination. Another thing the bill is trying to do is to encourage temporary special measures, that state parties to put some temporary special measures in place to ensure that women have access to leadership, decision-making. And from what is happening, because of past history of marginalization of women, you cannot bring a woman out and a man and you ask them to take a race. The man is already ahead. A woman had been marginalized for a long time in the past. So what temporary special measures do is that they begin to fill up these gaps. First of all, you can say in these appointive positions, you are appointing the cabinet, we are saying a minimum of 30% women. You are appointing your ministers. There are 10 ministers, at least 3 should be women. So the bill talks about affirmative action, about temporary special measures. Under the employment section, it says, where a man and a woman have the same job, equal value for equal work. So where they are both doing the same work, they should receive the same pay. And of course, people raise the issue of maternity leave. They say, well, employing a woman is not good for the company because she's either pregnant or she is on maternity leave or she's going off a school run for her kids. And this law is saying that if you grant a woman maternity leave, he should not count against her for any reason. Her pay remains intact. And we're still talking about the job that the women do, the unpaid work. We're saying that this should also be considered when you talk about salaries. Women have work that they do that is unpaid. So if you talk about maternity leave, you cannot discriminate against a woman because she's gone on maternity leave, because that maternity leave is work on its own.
Slowly, different countries are acknowledging, including our own, that the best way to take care of children is to take care of women. And so a dollar spent on women's health actually is a dollar that reverberates throughout the family, and it's a good way to take care of children. Mm-hmm. Slowly, is this being recognized in Nigeria as well?
Yes. Actually, the saying in Nigeria is that you train a woman, you train a nation. You train one woman, you train a nation, because the woman will train the children. So it's also being recognized gradually in Nigeria.
Is this going to be a model for other African countries, do you feel? I know that you've said you've had to compromise and take certain things out of the bill, and slowly you'll be able to add them back in. But just the route that you're going and the success that you are having, do you feel that other countries will look to Nigeria, who's such a leader, as possibly something that they would want to do in their country?
I'm even saying that some countries have gone ahead of Nigeria. Ghana, for instance, has gone ahead of Nigeria. Uganda, for instance, these countries have incorporated the provisions of these instruments in their national laws, in their constitutions, for instance. Uganda has it in its constitution. They have the issue of affirmative action, temporary special measures. They have all these rights in CEDAW in their constitution. So some countries have gone ahead of Nigeria. So Nigeria should actually be looking up to some of those countries. I would like to say that I am one of the 23 experts that monitor the implementation of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and it is called the CEDAW Committee. So This treaty, the CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, was adopted by the UN, United Nations, in 1979. Subsequently, this committee was set up to monitor implementation. And what our committee does is to hold governments accountable. Governments who have ratified CEDAW, who have set parties to CEDAW, hold them accountable. They are, each country that signs onto CEDAW is required to report on the level of its implementation of the convention 1 year after signatory, and subsequently every 4 years. So what the committee does, the committee receives reports. The committee then invites the state party to send a delegation before to defend the report. And this is called constructive dialogues with state parties. So what the committee does is also to give an opportunity for NGOs to submit what we call the shadow reports. So if you find areas where government has not actually presented the situation as it is, NGOs are they have the opportunity to submit reports to say this area, that area is not exactly what it is. We need you to engage our government to do this, to do that. And when the government comes before the committee will use this information that we have, because we're not in those countries, we don't understand what's going on there. So we use information that we get from alternative sources, like NGOs, like UN agencies, special agencies, you know, they present reports. And when we engage countries on the level of the implementation of the convention, we raise those issues that are there. So that is one. The other thing that the committee does is using the mechanisms that the optional protocol to CEDAW has provided. You know, in 1999, this optional protocol was adopted, and what it did was to provide for mechanisms that women, individuals, can use to bring petitions or complaints before CEDAW committee. Generally, the countries are held accountable for what's going in there, but then individually, people were feeling left out. So this optional protocol has now provided the communications mechanism, communications procedure, which means CEDAW can accept or receive complaints from individuals whose rights have been violated. CEDAW looks at it, and if it qualifies, we have criteria. One of those criteria is, have domestic remedies been exhausted? This person you are complaining about, what has happened to you? Have you utilized the national mechanisms, the courts, up to the appeal level, and then you didn't get justice, then you can come to us. So if you have not done that, the case is thrown out. If you have done that, the state party is invited to present their own case. When we have received all the information from both parties, the committee sits today, analyzes the case, and comes up with a decision. So this is communications procedure. And what is also critical about this is that state parties are held accountable, not just for the wrongs that they have done, but for the wrongs of third parties, where the state party has not taken special measures to ensure that this third party has done what it's supposed to do. And I'll give you an example of a case that came before, I won't mention the country, a case that came before the committee where a woman died while pregnant in a private clinic. So the family of the woman came to CEDAW to say that the woman was neglected and gave instances of how medical attention was not provided immediately. And CEDAW found the government accountable. Government's defense was, we don't know what happened, this is a private clinic. But we said that under the convention, the state party is also accountable for the deeds of private agencies where you have not taken measures to ensure. So that is one procedure. Then there's the inquiry procedure, where a complaint can come from NGOs, from anybody, to say, in my country, this is going on, and we don't think it is right. I'll give you an example of a country where we got a report that the local government had banned contraceptives for women, and in the poor communities, and these women were dying, getting pregnant and not getting attention and dying. So we sent a team to investigate. But the state party has to approve of this visit in the country. So the team goes in, speaks to the government, speaks to the individuals, and we came up with a report that government is accountable to women. Under the convention, you have to make sure that modern contraceptives are available, accessible, and affordable to women. And that's how the state government is trying to change the policies to get this going. So for CEDAW, I think it is a great treaty that women, you know, can use to protect their rights. And we have, if you Google CEDAW jurisprudence, you'll find so many cases that have been done and judgments, decisions given.
I know that in some countries, I just spoke with a man from Cameroon, the attitude of the government is that NGOs are like pests. They're a thorn in the side of government, because in some cases they're getting in between the government and very expensive contracts that are coming in to exploit the resources, for example, on an environmental level. And the cutbacks for the government people are in danger. Do you see slowly progress being made that individual rights are best protected by the international community imposed on the government? And will governments, will Nigeria end up seeing that this is a benefit to them? I mean, this is a hard road.
Yeah, in terms of the role of NGOs within communities, I think that even local NGOs do provide services that government acknowledges. For instance, during the reporting process, the new trend now in Nigeria is that government is throwing open the reporting process to everybody, include NGOs. They are trying to discourage presentation of shadow reports. What they are trying to do is to get the NGOs to be part of the presentation. So bring in all those information that you have, we can put it in the report, which was never there before. So now what government is trying to do is to discourage the kind of acrimony that goes on when they come before the committee. You find NGOs and government in, you know, loggerheads, which is not good. So for government in Nigeria, they're increasingly recognizing the work that NGOs are doing. So it may not become necessary for international organizations to come in, you know, and this is what they don't want. But in terms of CEDAW, for instance, we're not able to access it because we have not, the country has ratified it. So Nigerian women can access it. Nigerian women can use it. So I think government is coming to terms with working with NGOs, collaborating with NGOs, rather than being at loggerheads.
Seeing NGOs as a resource so that they don't come before the international community as, we don't want to see it on the front page, is what people say.
Exactly. But one thing that is going on in our country right now is that somebody in the legislature is trying to introduce a bill to set up a commission to regulate the work of NGOs. And NGOs are resisting this, because the NGOs do not want a situation where you have government-supported NGOs, you know, and then this group of NGOs are enemies of government because, of course, maybe they are trying to push government to respect the rights of people.
And you don't need middle people to be more efficient either, let alone watchdog.
Not exactly, because you don't trust the commission. I don't know what the commission is about. So people are saying people should regulate themselves, NGOs should regulate themselves.
Well, thank you very much for filling us in on a few of the things that are going on in Nigeria and around Africa. Mm-hmm. We'll look with a lot of interest to see if these bills are passed.
Thank you. And one thing I wanted to also say is I want to talk about the procedure, because, the U.S. has not ratified CEDAW, which is very, very unfortunate, and we are hoping that it's going to be done soon. The U.S. is a major power, and if they don't, they have not even ratified the Rome Statute, so they need to be part of this process, you know. But one thing I would like to talk about is the procedure for becoming a member of the committee, so that people who are interested can. Countries that are state parties to CEDAW are the only countries that can nominate people to stand for election as a member of the committee. So elections are held every other year. There's a procedure where the government nominates, and then the 189 countries who are state parties to CEDAW vote. And then the person that garners the majority votes wins. So I've just recently been re-elected for another 4 years in the committee.
So people who are interested can go to the United Nations Human Rights Office of the High Commissioner.
Yes.
In order to get more information about applying for to be on the committee.
Exactly, but they must come through the state party. You cannot as an individual apply. It's the government that will apply. I was nominated by the government of Nigeria. So that's all if you see the list of candidates, or what you will see is Nigeria, then you see Obinwankwo. So it's the state party that nominates. But once an expert is elected, the expert becomes independent. So we are addressed as independent experts. So you are no longer representing your government. You are there to do work irrespective of country you came from.
How many people are now part of the committee? Do you know about 20, how many?
23. Yes, it has always been 23. Yes.
And how long have you been meeting as a committee?
I think the committee was set up 1980, because the convention was adopted in 1979. The committee was set up 2 years or 3 years later. It's been meeting since then.
So 25 years, 26 years.
Well, I think they've even celebrated 30 years of CEDAW committee. Mm-hmm. I was elected a member of the coalition for the International Criminal Court, which is based in New York, to see to a ratification of the Rome Statute, which is the statute that governs the International Criminal Court. The whole aim is to have universal ratification, that is having all the countries of the world signing on to this statute so that the court can have access to these countries. So I was elected as a member representing Africa on the Coalition for the International Criminal Court.
Can you explain for people who may not have a background where the situation is now, and what would ratification accomplish?
We have worked with the court to ensure that the number of countries that have ratified the Rome Statute has been increasing by the day. I cannot give you that. I can find the number of countries that have come, but I know that for Africa, most of African countries have ratified the International Criminal Court.
And what does this power give? When you ratify, what is the implication?
When a country ratifies the Rome Statute, it means that citizens of that country can access the court where atrocities have been committed within the country and where the national judicial system has been unable to provide redress for this kind of atrocities. So it is the highest international court that deals with criminal matters, but it has to be a criminal matter of the highest magnitude. So what it does for individuals, and that's why we are asking for universal ratification, is that people will be able to access the services of the courts to bring to justice people who have perpetuated, atrocities in their countries.
In the international forum, when the national courts are unable to persevere, who, for example, would come before the court, possibly, if everyone in Africa signed on? I know Joseph Kony, for example, was the first person mm-hmm. to be actually convicted. Who might also be included?
Among the culprits to be convicted? Well, of course, you know that several trials are on now. It's difficult to predict who will be convicted, but it is easy to say who is likely to be indicted right now. Several situations have been investigated. Even in my country, Nigeria, my country has been investigated for atrocities committed in the crisis, ethnic crisis that occurred in Jos, as well as the Boko Haram insurgency. So the investigation is on. So Nigeria might likely come before the courts. So also different countries that are under investigation now.
As more countries sign on, does it strengthen the countries that have already signed, so there's a sense that everyone will have a common standard between countries?
Yes, it does strengthen the countries' positions. But what I have to also say now is that the ICC is having problems with the African Union. That's the African countries that have signed on. The African countries are Their position is that the ICC is targeting Africa only, that there are other countries of the world where atrocities are going on and they are not being brought to book. So, for instance, the Kenyan president and vice president were indicted and were actually standing trial. But you know that in most constitutions of African countries, you have the immunity clause, where serving presidents or governors or vice presidents and so on are not, you know, are not supposed to be indicted and tried while they are in office. But the Rome Statute does not have any immunity clause, which means that the ICC can target a serving president and bring him to court. So, but you saw the uproar that this attracted by having the president of Kenya appearing in court, in the dock and stuff. The African governments did not see that. They felt it wasn't respectful of Africa that you wait, you don't distract a serving president with this kind of thing. But you know, the Rome Statute does not have any provision for that. Whoever is indicted should be brought to the court. So that has its own backlash, because right now, the country, African Union, is encouraging African countries to withdraw from the ICC. And the role that we're trying to play as a coalition is to also dissuade this kind of conduct, you know, trying to get countries to understand that the African Union per se is not a member of the ICC or the Rome Statute. It is individual responsibilities. You have signed on, you have ratified, therefore you have an individual obligation to abide by the provisions of the Rome Statutes. So it's proving difficult, but we're hoping that with time, African countries will begin to understand. And the fact that the cases against the president of Kenya and his vice president have been withdrawn for now also is something we are using to encourage the African Union to allow, you know, countries to continue to comply with the requirements of the Rome Statutes.
Possibly we tried to expand the powers a little too soon, tried to go too fast, but people will catch up, hopefully. Well, thank you for all your hard work on everyone's behalf.
Thank you so much. Thank you.